So today we start a very long journey about one of the main topics in this course, which is the concept of quantum phases. And this is a notion that initially has been very important in condensed matter theory, but as we shall see, now this notion has expanded to many other topics. And what is it? What is a quantum phase? So yesterday we have seen that when we are dealing with a quantum many-body system, we have basically just one very strict requirement, that the Hamiltonians are local. And by that, we meant that Hamiltonians are sum of local operators. And we have used this notation. Right? So there are some of Hermitian operators that have a support on a subset X, which is the subset of our graph. And this X has a given volume and a given diameter. Okay, so this specifies the locality of the Hamiltonian. Other than that, everything is possible. You can place any type of operators that you want. So you see, there are infinite possibilities of quantum many-body Hamiltonians. And when we have infinite possibilities, we feel the need of classifying, right? You know, with fundamental theories, we don't feel the need of classifying. We have a Hamiltonian for electromagnetism, or a Lagrangian for electromagnetism, another one for the strong interaction, and one for gravity. And well, then we have the one for the weak interaction. That's it, right? There is no classification. But when we have infinite models and infinite Hamiltonians, then we just have the need to classifying, because not classifying amounts to not understanding anything. So basically the notion of a quantum phase is a way of classifying. So let me give a few examples. Let's say that I take two samples of iron, okay? And if I had to write down their Hamiltonians, they would be different, because different samples of iron are not exactly the same. Their crystalline structure is not exactly the same because there are defects. And one sample is larger than the other sample, may have a slightly different shape. And there are defects in the crystalline structure, and there are also impurities. There are other atoms in the piece of ore that are not iron, no matter how much you purify. But we still say, oh, this is iron, and this is iron. Okay? So you see, we bunch them together in something that is somehow the same. So we would like to say that they are in the same phase. Okay? So for us, just a second, a phase is an equivalence class. Okay? Yes.
Yeah. The phase could depend on, could be depending on global quantity, right? It's not just
Yes, so this is a very interesting remark. What does the phase depend on? And this is a question that will take us a lot of time to answer completely. So this is, in fact, a very profound question. So right now we are taking it slowly. We are just saying that the phase is an equivalence class. This means that we must find some relationship such that we say, oh, these two models, these two systems are equivalent, so they are the same, although they are different, right? Because they are, we say, microscopically different, and then whatever is important that makes them the same, we can call it macroscopic, as you suggest. Okay, so what makes two systems equivalent is one of the goals of this course. The second thing that we have to establish is what makes them quantum, okay? So it cannot just be the equivalence classes of a quantum system. So this is another one of the topics of this course, to understand what in a many-body system is specifically quantum. For instance, you could have a quantum many-body system that can be described classically pretty well. You know, for instance, some aspects of magnetism can be described classically pretty well. So yes, in the end, the underlying theory is quantum mechanically, but that is not specifically a quantum phase. Okay, so these are our two goals. And to this end, we start reviewing some notions of classical statistical mechanics to understand how classical phases are defined. And then we will try to mimic this notion of classical phases to give a first definition of quantum phase. Okay, so this is our goal. So in classical statistical mechanics, so I believe you all have taken a core course in classical statistical mechanics, you know that everything is about the free energy. Right? So if you know the free energy of the system, which is this, but this is the partition function of the system, then you know everything that you need to know about your system. You know, for instance, the expectation values of all your observable quantities. And just like yesterday we discussed when the thermodynamic limit does exist. And in classical physics, we do not have a problem with the structure of a Hilbert space, right? Because there is no Hilbert space. But we still need the free energy per particle to exist, this is what we call the free energy density, to be non-divergent in the thermodynamic limit. Okay, so this is still a requirement. And the considerations that I gave yesterday about, for instance, Coulomb interaction, they were not specifically quantum, those considerations still apply. Now, there is a very beautiful result in classical statistical mechanics that says if the free energy density exists, then, and this can be the function of several parameters, pressure, volume, temperature, okay? So let me call these parameters lambda. And one of them is temperature, always. If it exists, then it is analytic, but for a domain of codimension 1. So what does it mean? Is that if this is our domain with our parameters lambda 1, lambda n, and the free energy density is defined here, then it is also analytic in this domain, but for something that has codimension 1. So lines in this case, right? The codimension 1 of 2 is 1. So you see that our space of parameters splits in regions in which the free energy density is completely analytic within that region. So here, for instance, it is analytic. But it is not analytic on this line. It's not analytic on this line, it's not analytic on this line. Okay, yes?
The lambda is chosen so that we get this, or, I mean, physically we would say we expect lambdas to be these physical parameters, but how are we sure that we get all of them? Is it only when we get this property?
No, that's a great... that is a great question. So I'm gonna give you an example, okay? So we remember what is the partition function. The partition function is the sum over all our configurations of the system, whatever are our variables, of e to the minus beta, the energy of that configuration. Okay? Now, so everything depends on what gives you the energy, which is the Hamiltonian of the system. Okay. So these parameters are whatever parameters you have in the Hamiltonian. So it is the model that is describing your physical system that is giving you the parameters. For instance, when you, let's say we talk about water and we are talking about classical phase transitions in water, then our parameters are pressure, volume, and temperature. Okay? Let me give another example. So this is a toy model, and we will be working a lot with toy models because toy models are simplified, idealized models in which we can make precise mathematical considerations, and such that they capture all that is essential to understand. So we, in theoretical physics, we usually study models, and then we hope that some of these models with some dressing up describe some physical situation. But in theoretical physics, we always start with some model. So the model we have in mind is the classicalizing model. Okay, so we have a lattice, and on this lattice we place Ising variables, also called Ising spins, on the sides of this lattice, which means variables that have only two possible values, plus and minus one. And a given collection, a given assignment of sigma I for every I, so I decide every sigma what value does it have, is called the configuration of the system, and I will denote it with this notation. So this is an assignment of the values of sigma I for every I. The Hamiltonian of the classicalizing model is given by let me see if in my notes I used the same couplings. Yeah. Where this, So this notation here means these are all the edges in the lattice. Okay, so we have a lattice that is made only of links. So we sum over all the edges, we have this term. This is called the Ising coupling, and this is called external magnetic field. Okay. So you see that, well, how many parameters do we have that specify this Hamiltonian? Well, you see that here we have two, J and H. However, one of them can always be reabsorbed in our unit of measures, right? So in units of J, because this is an energy scale, right? This is in the Hamiltonian. So in units of J, this coupling is one, and this coupling is H over J, right? So effectively, we actually have just one parameter, because one is just an overall energy scale. So we have one parameter H, and the second parameter that appears in the partition function is beta. That is the temperature. So you see the two parameters, the two lambdas for this model are beta and H. There is nothing else, because nothing else describes this model. Okay. Very well. Okay, so one interesting quantity is as we said before, everything can be obtained by the free energy. Okay? Specifically, let me compute things from the free energy density. So let me compute, for instance, the derivative of the free energy density with respect to this parameter H. Let's see what we find. So this is a very standard thing in statistical mechanics. How many of you have done these calculations before? Okay, so it's good that not every of you has done it. So we are going to discover something very interesting. Okay, so let's do this calculation. So F is capital F over V. V is the number of particles. So let me just write 1 over N. And then we have to take the derivative with respect to H of this. So we get minus KBT 1 over Z. Right? And then we have the derivative of with respect to H of this object. Okay, so let's do that. So this is the sum over all the configurations of the spins. And now I have to differentiate this, and I will have a minus beta. Okay? And now I have to differentiate this, and this gives me minus the sum of sigma I, and then I have again the exponential. Do we agree? Okay. So you know that beta is just 1 over KBT. So these two terms cancel. And as you can see, what we find is 1 over N, then there is a minus. And then what is this? 1 over Z, the sum over all the configurations of this quantity. I took out the minus. So this quantity with this term. What is it? It's the average, right? It's the average because e to the minus beta e over z is our Boltzmann distribution, is the probability distribution of a system at equilibrium with temperature beta. So this is just equal to the average of the sum of all the spins. We can call this quantity magnetization, okay? And the magnetization over N is the magnetization per site. So we have found that minus dF over dH is equal to this. This is the magnetization per site. Okay, let me define it here. Okay? And now we find something interesting, that if we were to plot this quantity as a function of the temperature for the Ising model, say in a square lattice, we would see something like this. So on the x-axis, we have T rescaled by number Tc that we call critical temperature, and we will see something like this. And there are a number of ways of obtaining this figure. We can solve analytically this Hamiltonian. Is it possible? And I think some of you have done it in statistical mechanics, and there will be a section in my notes where we do that. Or you can do some Monte Carlo method, right? And find this shape. Okay. So you see, this is the magnetization, and this magnetization shows that there are two different behaviors when T smaller than a certain critical temperature Tc or greater than Tc. So for T greater than Tc, the magnetization is identically zero. For T smaller than Tc, the magnetization depends on T. Okay, and it is non-zero. And it turns out that at Tc, the first derivative of m with respect to h, for the value of h equals zero, is divergent. Okay? So if this quantity, which is the derivative of this, is divergent, this means that f is non-analytic, okay? And we call this point a critical point because there is a non-analyticity in small f, okay? So this means that, for instance, we are going from here to here, okay? And at some point, at t equal tc, so if I want to do it, if I say that this is T, then it would be like doing something like this. Okay? And this is Tc, whereas this is H. For a certain value of H, in this case is only H equals zero, you find a point of non-analyticity. So this is our first definition of a phase, which is, okay, so in a domain in which the free energy is analytic, that is a phase, and then there is another phase, which is another domain, and the boundary of these two phases is a critical point and discriminates the two phases. Okay, so this is a definition. And like all definitions, they're very easy to give. Then what does it mean? Why we care, right? Why this phenomenon gives us anything that we are happy about, that we think it's important. So it is worthwhile to actually compute this second derivative, okay? So I will compute this object. Okay, and I call it chi. So this is called magnetic susceptibility because it tells me how my system responds if I change a little bit the magnetic field. Okay, so I change a little bit the magnetic field, H, and I want to see how my magnetization reacts to this change. And because this is the derivative, this is like a first order response. First order response, as you know, is linear. So this is also called the linear response. And typically, linear response is what is called the dissipation. Because typically what happens is that you poke a little bit your system, and then this thermalizes and dissipates. So whatever we have on this hand is what people call dissipation, which is basically linear response. And let's see what we find, okay? So let's take this this derivative. Okay. So we have minus 1 over n, and then d over dh. And what we have here is 1 over z, the sum over all the configurations of sigma I e to the minus beta h. Right? This is what we are doing. Good. Okay. Now, there are many minuses that I'm going to hopefully get right because they cancel each other. Okay, so let's first differentiate this term. Okay, so we will have 1 over z, and then we have the sum over all the configurations okay, and now we have to differentiate this term again, and I think I forgot this. Okay. So I have this thing. Okay. Now when I differentiate this term, I first get a minus beta. And then I get a minus the sum over sigma I again. Okay. And now I have to differentiate this term, and this gives me minus 1 over z square times the derivative of e to the minus beta h, which is again a minus beta, and then this sum with the minus. Sigma I, and then we have e to the minus beta h, and we have e to the minus beta h again, right? Because it is the term that I didn't differentiate. Yeah.
There should be two sums.
Yeah, there are these two sums. Okay. Okay, so now let's put together all these pieces, and we have beta over n. And now what is this? This is the, I forgot the sigma I here. Okay. Well, you see, this is the square of the term, this part. Okay? So this is indeed M average squared, right? Because I'm averaging and then I'm multiplying again for that average. This term instead, oh, and here I forgot to put the e to the minus beta h and the f. Okay. This term instead is the average of sigma, the sum of sigma I squared. So this is this, and this is a minus. Okay. So you see, this is called the variance, right? Which is a measure of the fluctuations of M. It's a measure of the fluctuations because this object is also the average of M minus average of M squared and then averaged. So it is the average distance that M has from its average. Yeah?
So just a quick question. So throughout this whole calculation, as you were poking the system, were you keeping the temperature fixed? Because to me, it feels that H, the parameter that you have there, the coupling should depend on the temperature, because if I remember correctly from stat mac.
Yeah, so this object does depend on temperature, right? There are averages here.
Yeah.
So.
Wait, were you fixing the temperature? Like, are we at one temperature and we poke in the system? Or no?
Right, yeah. So for every temperature, you have these fluctuations.
Okay, so then going back to the parameter space, you said that before that we had two parameters, temperature and age.
Yeah.
To me, I felt I only had, like, there has, isn't there, ask, is there a dependence between age and the temperature?
Like, they're separate. Yeah, so you see it in our model. H is this formula here, is this this function. And the partition function is the sum over all the configuration, so e to the minus beta H.
Little h or big h?
The little h, but it feels like as the temperature change, it feels like if we go into the, if you think in the renormalization scheme, it feels the h should be changed as you change the temperature. So there is a dependence of h and temperature of in terms of the temperature. No.
So h is this parameter in this function. So, you know, so I don't know exactly right now what you have in mind for small h, but h is just this.
But it's a coupling, isn't it? A coupling.
No. Yes, this is the coupling with the external magnetic field, small h. Mm-hmm.
Well, to me, I feel physically it should depend on the temperature. As I change the temperature, the coupling might couple more to the system than.
No, so obviously in this model, I'm not coupling more to the system as a function of the temperature. So the temperature is just telling you what is the probability, because this is the meaning of temperature, of having a certain energy. Okay, so we have these fluctuations. Okay, so for every, you see, this is an average. This average depends on the probability distribution. Well, this distribution depends on the temperature, so this depends on the temperature. Okay, so what is the behavior of this object with the temperature? Okay. So at, one can show that at T equal to C, this quantity diverges. So if this quantity diverges, it means that these fluctuations are diverging. Okay, so we learn one first thing, that critical points are important because it means that when I average over all my possible configurations, from sample to sample, the total magnetization fluctuates a lot around the average. Second thing we need to understand. Yesterday discussion, we said, oh, one of the most important things that we will be talking about will be correlations, okay, between different parts of the system. Now, let me introduce classically what are correlations. So we call connected, so given some quantity that depends on some position, xi, the connected correlation functions, cij, are the expectation value of this product minus the product of the averages. So mathematically, it's a measure of how much this average cannot be factorized in the product of the two averages. But physically, it means also this. You can see that this is equal to the average of Oxi minus the average of Oxi. So this is the fluctuation of the value of O at the site I times Oxj minus Oxj average. And this is the fluctuation of the quantity O at the site J. So this is the correlation between the fluctuations. So saying that the connected correlation functions diverge or are very large, if we say that, this would in turn mean that the fluctuations of one spin at the site I are highly correlated with the fluctuations of another spin at a different, at a distant spin j. Okay? So that there is high correlation between the fluctuations at different points. Okay. Now, let's go back to this formula here, where we have seen that the dissipation, the linear response, is equal to these fluctuations. Oh, by the way, this is an example of the fluctuation dissipation theorem that connects the linear response of the system with the fluctuations that you have in the system. So let's remember what is M. So M is the sum over all the sigma I variables. So this becomes, so it was the average of M squared, right? So it is the average of M squared, which is this. Right? This is M squared. And I can write it like this. Minus, again, the sum over ij, this. So you see that this is the sum and I forgot beta over n, right? I forgot beta over n. So this beta over n, the sum over all my correlation functions. Now imagine that my system is a translational invariant, okay? So that there is no difference between one site and another site. So this means that I can take sum only over all the correlation functions between the point I and the point zero and get a factor capital N from the sum over J. So this becomes just beta N over N cancel the sum over I of CI zero. Okay, good. So one can compute these correlation functions in the Ising model using either the exact solution or numerics, and one finds that for t greater than tc, ci0 goes like, so let me write the cij. Cij goes like e to the minus the Euclidean distance between these two points over xi. So it's exponentially decaying when we are in the paramagnetic phase, which is the phase on the right-hand side of TC. Yes?
Can you repeat the logic from going from ij to i0?
Yeah. So if the system is translationally invariant, this means that there is no difference between the indices I and j. So I can just compute ci0 for a fixed value of j that I call 0. And then for every j, I will get the same value. So I get n times the same value. So I get the factor n. Yeah.
Yeah, also a question. Is it in this language that fluctuation is a sum of correlation?
Yeah, you see that. So these fluctuations are the sum of these correlation functions, yes.
So yeah. In general, in any statistical system, is it, can we make this claim?
Yes, yes. So this is a very typical case. I'm showing it in a model to make things clear, but yes, absolutely. Okay. So this exponential decay is very important. It means that when two sides are distant more than xi, the fluctuations are not correlated. Basically, even if they fluctuate each for their own. Within xi, the system, the fluctuations are highly correlated. If this is fluctuating, this one is fluctuating in a correlated way with the other one. And what does that, so this is what is called the correlation length. It's the length scale over which the system is correlated. And now we can upper bound this number, and this is a type of techniques that we will be using a lot, by, let's say, the maximum value of this function within xi, let me call it a square, times the volume of integration, which will be psi to the d. And okay, so it's upper bounded by this number. Now, what happens when instead these fluctuations diverge? If these fluctuations diverge, this means that the correlation functions have to diverge, right? Because they are just this and this. And if they diverge, and this has this form, means that xi has to diverge. Okay? So in fact, near the critical point, psi diverges like t to the minus tc to a certain power, minus nu. And as a consequence, also chi will diverge with some power law that we call gamma. So these are called critical exponents. And one thing why they are very interesting is that they are universal. So now maybe we go to something that you had in mind. What does it mean that they are universal? Imagine that I choose a model that is not exactly the Ising model, but has something in common. So for instance, let's say that I introduce also a coupling between the spin at the site I. And so you remember, I and J are connected by a link. So just to have a picture in mind, imagine that this is a chain. You have I plus 1 in the x direction, or if you are in two dimensions, you have I plus 1 in the x direction and I plus 1 in the y direction, right? So now imagine I introduce a new coupling that it is from the site I and the site I plus 2. And I try to solve the model again. Well, I will find exactly the same critical indexes. So in this sense, these are universal. There are many different microscopic theories that all have the same critical indices. And there is, I believe you have taken a class on this, a technique to show what is the representative point of all these phases. The point that has these critical indices is the fixed point of the renormalization group. So this means that both the Ising model and the one with next near neighbor coupling, they all flow to the same to the same model. Okay, so these are universal. Okay. So we understand why in classical physics, non-analyticities of the free energy are considered important. And it is because you have some quantity called, in this case, order parameter that is called the magnetization in this case, that has a different qualitative behavior before TC and after TC. And at the critical point, you have very large correlations in the fluctuations of the spins. It's saying, oh, something dramatic is happening to the system because it's trying to reorganize itself. And this is what drives the transition between a ferromagnetic phase in which you have a net magnetization. Remember, that is the net magnetization in the limit of H going to zero. It means that even when I take to zero the external magnetic field, you have a residual magnetization. And the paramagnetic phase in which once you take H to zero, then magnetization disappears. Okay, so this is why these divergences of the free energy are important in classical phase transitions. Okay, so now let's go to what we want. We want to talk about quantum phases and quantum phase transitions. Yeah?
How do you get that upper bound? And is A, is that just a number? Is that like the length between sites?
No, this is just, so within psi, this function will have some maximum value. And I call it A square. And this is something in these spatial dimensions. So my domain has a volume psi to the D. So, you know. So I'm summing this function right in this domain, and I say, okay, I can bound this integral by the maximum value times the size of the domain. Okay, so let's, to understand the quantum case, so what is that we want to do? We want to look at fluctuations of our observable quantities that are the fluctuations, in our case, of our observables, right? The Hermitian operators. Okay, so let's recall some basic facts about quantum mechanics. Let's say that I have some Hermitian operator And I'm writing it in the basis in which it is diagonal, right? So this is the so-called spectral resolution of this observable. And let's say that I am in some generic state psi of my quantum system. And you may remember that I can write this also in its spectral resolution, right? Because it's still an Hermitian operator. Okay. Are you familiar with this notation?
Okay. Why there is phi an operator on state?
So this is the so-called density matrix.
Okay, I see.
Of your state psi. So it is an Hermitian operator such that it is positive definite, means all its eigenvalues are at least zero, and it has trace one, and it's Hermitian. Okay? And this represents any possible quantum state of the system. In particular, it represents non-pure states. And this is indeed a non-pure state, because this Q alpha are the eigenvalues, right? So they are all positive, all non-negative, and the sum is one. So a collection of numbers that are non-negative, the sum is one, is what? It's a probability distribution. So you see that this is a convex combination with a probability distribution of pure states. Each of these is a rank one projector, is a pure state. So this is a mixed state, unless you are in the extremal case in which this probability distribution is 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, in which case you have a pure state. So as you can see, this Q alpha are a probability distribution that has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. It's just expressing the fact that we are given an ensemble of states that are distributed with Q alpha. This is a classical probability distribution that is describing an ensemble of states. Now, if I ask you, what is the probability of getting the outcome OI when I measure this observable? Okay, so you know, if I measure this observable, the only possible outcomes of this measurement are these numbers, the eigenvalues. And they come with a probability. What is this probability? What does quantum mechanics tell us?
You twice average.
Huh?
You first of all average over the quantum state, then you average over the mixed state.
Beautiful. Yes. So your colleague is giving a very sensible answer, which is, he is applying probability theory. He says, you know, with the probability Q alpha, I am in this state. So it will be the conditional, the sum with these probabilities of the probability that comes from this. Okay, so let me write it the way your colleague said. And what is the probability of getting OI if you are in this state?
Is due to the trace over
alpha.
It will be this, right? The overlap between this state and the eigenvector of corresponding to that eigenvalue, modulus square. And you might be familiar with the fact that all of this can be summarized in a very compact formula, which is just do you notice that if you take the trace of your state psi with this projector, you get exactly that.
Then the final result should be trace over all times psi.
This is probably not.
I cannot hear you very well. So what you have in mind is this. If you sum over all these outcomes with this probability, then you get this. But this probability also is a trace in this thing. Okay, so now we notice something. Why I'm doing this? Because we are talking about the fluctuations. The fluctuations come from an average. The average comes from a probability distribution. What are our probabilities now? Are these objects, right? Sorry, these objects. The probability of I is this whole thing. So you see that in this whole thing, the quantum part of the probability and the classical part of the probability are mixed together. So your fluctuations will happen because you have fluctuations in your probability distribution Q alpha, and because you have quantum fluctuations coming from this probability distribution here. So this means that if we, at some point, find very high fluctuations, we wouldn't know whether they are due to this part, or to this part, or to some combination of the two. But definitely, we would not be able to conclude that if you have large fluctuations, it's due to the quantum fluctuations. The quantum fluctuations have to come only from this part. So, okay, so we have a problem. How do we solve it? What do you think we should do? Any idea? Just try. Let's try some idea.
Maybe we can try some pure states.
Yes, great. Exactly. Why don't we do that? So, the very simple idea is often the best one. Why don't we try just for the pure case? So, if we are in a single state alpha, then the probability of getting the outcome I is just this overlap, if we're in a pure state. And whatever high fluctuations I get are of quantum nature. Okay, so this is a good step towards the solution. Now, next step. Okay, so we must be in a pure state that must represent some equilibrium state of the system. Which one is it? Who said that?
The ground state.
The ground state, right? Because our equilibrium state is this one. The Gibbs state, and as we know, this is very mixed. Unless we go to zero temperature, which is the ground state, and then this becomes just one state, or at most a few states if your system is degenerate. But let's make the simple case that the system is non-degenerate. But this degeneracy is not very important because you don't have a large probability distribution over many, many states. It's essentially unique, the ground state. Yeah, I will take this back. What I'm saying is that the degeneracy right now is not important. So we have at t equals zero, we have a pure state. So in the ground state, all the fluctuations are quantum fluctuations. So if we want to look at the concept of quantum phase, we have to look at the ground state of a Hamiltonian. Not its Gibbs state, not its excited states, but the ground state. Very well. I'm almost done. Just one thing. So our Hamiltonian, remember this, is this object. And we want to look at the ground state of this object. But then we want to know how this ground state changes when we change some parameters. But now these parameters cannot be the temperature, right? I cannot draw a diagram with T over TC because we've frozen the system at T equals zero. So we are only left with the other parameters, lambdas, all those but the temperature. In the case of the Ising model, all we have is small h. So we will have a phase diagram that is one dimensional. This is h critical. And on one side, we will have one phase. On the other side, we will have some other phase. I didn't write the quantum Hamiltonian yet, but I will. I'm just saying there is only one parameter. But generally, the Hamiltonian depends on all these parameters lambdas, which means that these operators must depend on all these parameters lambda. And now, what is that is developing a non-analyticity? Remember that our free energy is E minus TS. And free energy density is the energy density minus the entropy per site. But at T equals zero, this is just the energy density. So quantum critical points are points in which E, the ground state energy density, is non-analytic. Okay? So quantum critical points are lambdas such that the ground state energy, epsilon lambda, this is the one divided by n, is non-analytic. Okay, so tomorrow we will talk about in what way this thing can be non-analytic. Just remember one theorem that if this is, now I'm not dividing by n, I will stop dividing by n from now on. If this is the ground state energy of the Hamiltonian H lambda, then this is a function of lambda, right? Because for every lambda, I have a ground state energy. And the premise is that H is a smooth function of lambda. So it is infinitely differentiable. Question, if a matrix is a smooth function of some parameters, are its eigenvalues a smooth function of their parameters? Okay, so there is a theorem that says, oh, its eigenvalues are just continuous functions of the parameters. So they are continuous, but not necessarily infinitely differentiable. So if we want to look for non-analyticity of the ground state energy, we must look at some derivative of the energy. Okay? And so tomorrow we will talk about the quantum version of the Ising model and learn everything about it, including how to diagonalize it. Okay.